excited to have Mr. Cocky back. I don't know if you remember the last time you were here. It was a while ago, huh? Yeah, a little bit. So we are very happy to have him back here. He's not only a very talented musician, but he's a really witty guy. Please welcome to the stage of the Richfield Class, Mr. Leo Cocky.
Thank you. changed since then, and some of them work out in other ways. Some of them just lay there. I tend to slight them and have a, develop a greater regard for the ones that morph. But I have learned that some of them are old enough that I've learned that the morph is no guarantee of improvement, and that I have to be careful. This thing began after, not because of, but after a trip a friend of mine and I took when we became, as I seem to bring up all the time, the first two people to smuggle something into Mexico. Shortly after this event, we kind of went our separate ways. Not so much because we had different, you know, goals in mind, but because the state had a goal in mind for him and one that he didn't agree with, nor did I. Every now and then we sort of crossed paths, and he became like a cloud. He'd sort of waft by here and there. I was reminded of an ant I knew that crawled up on a... Maybe I should say I am reminded of an ant I knew that crawled up on a cold rock somewhere 10,000 years ago and sneezed. Which leads me to wish that I could say this next tune is called Gesundheit. But it's not. I'm more interested in that ant than I am in my friend Don at the moment. That's my problem. But recently we had time for more of a conversation than you get from an isobar on a graph somewhere. I learned that for many, many years, Don has been riding the rails. He's quit now because he can't really do it anymore. It's either the gangs or the feds. So all of the, you know, good times are gone. I don't know if you've ever... I've learned a lot about riding the rails sort of touching stories I think I've ever heard, which is when Don and his friend, who I asked them, what do you do? You know, yeah, we all have questions about it. What do you do? How do you know which way the train is going? He said, it depends which end the engine is on. You believe that? And then the other one is, once you get on, what do you do if it's still going and you want to get off? Or what do you do if it's headed north in the, you know, in January and you're in the t-shirt you had in, under the bridge in Miami? He said it didn't matter. Why? He said we're drunk. We're drunk all the time. So they're drunk in Nebraska. They're heading from the east to the west. And it's twilight, crepuscule in Nebraska. And one of us, he said, leaned out to look ahead. I don't know why he would do that, but that's what somebody did. And there was, and the horizon was on fire. There was this huge prairie fire. And he and his buddy were rhapsodic about this. They're both hanging on, leaning out to watch this wonderful twilight prairie fire from a vantage point that no one could share. As rare as, you know, I'm hearing, never mind, I was gonna go back to the ant. There's something there, I'm convinced of it, but I don't know what it is. at a ball, hanging on, trying not to fall off, and looking at this amazing thing that kept getting bigger and more glorious. He said, when we realized that we were going to go through the fire. So I did not write the tune because of that. That event did not occur because I wrote this tune when I did, which was not written because he and I had smuggled something into Mexico. And I'd like to play it for you now. Thank you. the door. Sailed the foreign countries and walked upon the shore. I guess the guy she married was the best part of my life. She took it cause it drove a pickup truck. And I guess I owe it all around the ground. Times all my running around. One of these days I might be in your town. And I guess I owe it all to Babylon. Herb Alpert came to Tijuana Brass. We're in June here. I'm here. But when you do this, that's flat. Yeah, right. Or it gets really bad here. So you hear it better. It's not too bad. Maybe I'm wrong. If you're a guitarist and you have to play with a pedal steel or a piano, you have to sharp your low E because of your high E, because of this phenomenon. It wasn't a phenomenon until Bach invented it. People think he was such a good guy. He was. I got to play this next tune once with Chet Atkins and Doc Watson. We all, each of us, been asked to show up at a photography studio. None of us were told that there'd be two other clowns there with their guitars. And we were supposed to individually be the cover boy of an airline magazine. And the only comfort of finding out that these two interlopers were there was that they fell for the same ruse I did. And they'd asked, and supposedly the article would be about our relationship with our favorite guitar, which none of us, you know, they asked him, would you bring your favorite guitar? And he can't, because the airline crushed it years ago. And what we had, and we had nothing to do, you know, we're waiting for the camera or whatever, and we're kind of depressed. And so we played for a while. I love being able to say that. And we played for a while, and this tune, and I knew that Doc liked it. He'd heard it in some other places where we got put on stage. And when I got to what must have been the end of the thing, actually we got to the end of it, Chet said, asked me what it was, and I couldn't tell him. I said, you know, John Fahey has the copyright on it, but I told him what I did know, which I got from meeting John for the first time in Portland, in Oregon. And I asked him about this section. You know, nothing to that. That's because that's not what he did. He had something really tricky there and really neat. And I could not figure out what it was. And so I asked him, you know, how do you do that? And he said, I don't know. I said, you wrote it. And tell me. And he wouldn't. Write it, really. I stole that whole thing from Sam McGee. And Chet said, well, I knew Sam McGee. He didn't write anything like that. So, it's a new tune of mine. And I just... what are called the Zoom title. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on around John. There's a couple, I think two books coming out. One of them might be good, one of them will probably be horrible. And maybe I shouldn't say that. So there's a film going and giving us sort of a retrospective of his career through the fundamental. several of the books of his have been published posthumously. House, the place I used to live. something going on in Australian show business right now, which is the promoters are all either retiring or have died. And they've had, I think it's a 12-year drought now in Perth. Down there, I've worked with over 26 years. He's still living, he's still working. He's one of, there aren't a lot of tour managers in Australia, and he's one of them, and worked for a company called Hocking Vigo, which is an extraordinary outfit, and first brought me down there in '76. Out of the country, the local promoter will always send somebody with you to basically make sure you don't run away. It's really, I really believe that. And you know, you have no choice in the matter, and you have to put up with each other. Generally, it works out. And only because musicians have such sophisticated social skills. People who lived alone in a little room for decades. And then one day, you're here, all these people are like, what the hell? And you get a tour manager from somewhere. But he told me the last time we worked together, he said, you know, we've worked together, this was 26 years into it, he said, you're the only act I've worked with here, and he did a lot of stuff, he's still doing it, who wears the same clothes when he goes on stage that he's been wearing all day long. He said, thank you. I don't want to carry around all that stuff. It's what soap is for. I met Adrian Lake in Philadelphia one year, and I said, you know, I'm trying to find something that I can wear into the shower so that it'll dry as fast as I do. And it's not going to lose, you know, I'm into the power to weight ratio, Adrian. And he said, so am I. And he said, I'm wearing it. And I've got to admit that what he was wearing kind of grossed me out. But he looked like the Michelin Man, and it was a... It was something, but it was lightweight, it did dry, he said, in less than 2 hours, and he wore it into the shower. It's just soap up, and everybody's clean, and it's great. It's a rogue skill, and I said, well, what is that stuff? And he said, it's parachute soap. So it just blew him up. I'm going out to find some. This will dry in about 2 hours. I'm not going to go any further with it. Traveling is it's you know, it's in a way it never loses its charm. Another way it loses it immediately. It's hard to I had a dentist a long time ago. He was working on whatever disaster I had in my mouth, and he said, "Ooh, you don't want to, you know, what? Or in a whore?" And he said, "You know, you have a really big tongue." Keep it to yourself. I don't know how big my tongue is. You know. I said something like, and he said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Doesn't that ever bother you?" It does now. my shirt to dry. I'm going to sleep for a while, but before I can, I have to figure out what I'm going to do with my tongue. Oh, there's my tongue. You can't just throw it out on the pillow. What a guy. You know, that's the opposite of a bedside manner. Supposed to take a short break here. This is imposed upon me by management. How many things when you're having a good time do you want to stop in the middle of it? Excuse me, darling. Mr. Romance will be back shortly. So I'll do that. I suppose it's about 15 minutes. But unfortunately, I just remembered I was supposed to do it, but it leaves me wondering what the hell I would play on a break. In other words, nothing that would finish the set, but just enough to indicate that, well, I've said this before, but it bears repeating. I have had dreams, once I figure out what to do with my tongue and my shirt and all of that, where I'm playing somewhere and I take a break and I come back and you don't. Thank you. I get to stop if I don't like what I'm doing. And a lot of people can do that. Still don't like it.
Okay.
since you've been gone. Had a sport coat, I still remember, was ill, didn't show up, and a substitute teacher walked in. Man, let me see where I am. This guy walked in, he wrote his name on the blackboard, and he turned around and he said, "You can tell from my name that I'm not interested in Oklahoma history." His name was Hank Dreadfulwater. And, you know, our hearts soared. Can we go home now? You can come with us if you don't want. And he said, "So I'm going to tell you about Korea," and our hearts sank. And he just launched right into it. He said, "I was in a tent along with three other guys on a hill full of tents in the middle of the winter in Korea, when a tent downhill from us blew up, killing all four guys in the tent." Well, that's better. It's more than Oklahoma did in about 170. He said they had buried a 50-gallon drum of Raisin Jack under their floorboards and under the tent. And I raised my hand, and I didn't want to say, "How do you make Raisin Jack?" I didn't want to betray myself. So I said, "Mr. Dreadfulwater, what is Raisin Jack?" And he looked at me, and he gave me a look, and I kind of, you know, quailed a little bit. And I realized now it was the look he gave the kid you knew was coming, who you could now blow up. "I'm going to blow you up." And he said, "Well, it's raisins, potatoes, and water." And I, you know, so I went home, I got some three mason jars filled with this stuff, but partly because I didn't want to go to all the work, and partly because I was a modern child, I used yeast instead of potato peelings, and threw it all in the jars, stuck them in my dad's garage, big old wooden garage, and I'd stick my head in there about 30 times a day to see if it was done yet. I mean, this is my first brew. I'm in a brand new vintner. I don't know how it works. After a few days, they blew up. And fortunately, nobody was in there. I could have wiped out my dad, maimed him, myself. Because they were bombs. There were little chunks of glass stuck in the wood in the garage. And on one of the crossbeams, a heel of one of the mason jars had survived. It had about that much of my first vintage in it. So I used the method that vintners have used for eons to check for broken glass. And it's kind of... Despite the way the garage smelled, which was bad, I had a slug of this stuff. This is the first time, that was my first drink, and it was the first time I quit drinking. You and me. said, ring, ring, golden ring, around the sun, around your pretty thing. It's more of a tuned rhythm, and you chunk it all the time. But if you lay back on it, you can get it to come out, and it's an amazing sound. And David and I were recording. We're in the studio, and I got my hands on his Bajo Sexto, and started fussing with it. And it's just three chords, and the next thing I knew, maybe half an hour had gone by. And I'm doing nothing but, how does that go? Oh, I don't know. For about half an hour, just 1, 4, 5. What now? 1, 4. I went blank, and I realized that I'd been going on drooling, in effect, just pure drivel, forgetting entirely that David's sitting over here waiting for something to do. And I opened my eyes, and I was really embarrassed, but David was playing, and he's into it. We became idiots at the same time, which was really fortunate for me. And because of that, I wanted to keep a track, which was, you know, so I started reciting some stuff. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed,
yeah.
It went on and on, and we finally just wore each other out. I got about halfway through it, and I didn't know where it was going until I got back to the Beverly Garland Howard Johnson's. Wanted to give me a rate the next time I'm there. And I smoked. I got up the next morning and I smoked one of Joe's cigars. And I got sicker than a dog. And I wrote the rest of the tune.
Snow in the deep midwinter.
Thank you.
you'll hear.
I don't know what I did on that.
Thank you.